Welcome to a Prevent Connect audio conference recording. The following was recorded on May 22nd at a Call to Men's 2009 Annual National Conference in New York City, New York. To learn more about A Call to Men, visit their website at www.acalltomen.org.
This next presentation is going to bring together a panel of men who are national leaders in the field of ending violence against women. These are names that are no stranger to most of you in the room. And they are going to lead us into that next piece that Ted was just talking about, which is looking at the issue of prevention. So how do we sort of step up and move in that direction? So I'm going to invite my panelists to come up and join us. The panel will be moderated by Jackson Katz, and he will be joined by Oliver Williams, who most of you know, Etione Aldonando, who many of you know, whose books I believe are out in the lobby, Rob Okun. Yes. And David Garvin. So I think this is a very prestigious panel that we have here, and we have them for the next hour, so enjoy.
Wow. Thank you very much, Gwen and Ted. That was great, Ted.
As ever.
And I just want to say, everybody's been thanking Ted and Tony and Dolores and A Call to Men, but I just want to say thank you for making this all happen. And I really appreciate it, and I'm honored to be part of this. And I know, I'm sure I'm speaking for my colleagues, although they can speak for themselves, but I just personally want to say thank you. It's a great event, and here we are. And I also want to say we're at the, you know, kind of latter stages of a conference, and I understand, as many of the people in this room, I have been to many conferences, and we know conference fatigue starts to set in, no matter how inspiring the presentations are. It's been quite an emotional day for many of us. And so, but we're kind of in the home stretch. We have one more panel after this with dynamic young men. But we'll do our best to be engaging as well. And we're going to, all of us are going to speak, obviously, but we're going to also hope that we have some time for people to say something and participate as actively as you can in the short time frame we have. I'm going to frame the issues for the panel, if you will, or for this discussion, and then turn it over to the panel. But I just wanted to introduce the panel just to make sure that people know. If you raise your hand, Rob Okun, Oliver Williams, David Garvin, Etione Aldorando. Just wanted to make sure everybody knew who you were looking at. Thank you. Now, when I was early on discussing with Tony and Ted about this panel, one of the things that we discussed was, how do we scale up our work? How do we expand our work? How do we go way beyond what we've already been doing? What is the vision that we can bring to go beyond conferences or go beyond the work that many of us have been doing for a long time in our communities and you know, on small scale or even on a bigger scale? I mean, as Eve Ensler talked about this morning, and we all know, these problems are enormous. Right? And to stay at the level that we're at, which is a handful of organizations, a small number of men in a multicultural sense, both in the United States and other parts of the world, doing good work is really not adequate to the size of the problem. We need to honestly be more ambitious in figuring out how we can further our work, institutionalize it wherever possible, expand it, and hold our leaders at every level accountable for addressing these issues in a more systematic way and a more upfront way. And so the idea of this discussion is to talk about what we can do going forward over the next few years, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, but to be as ambitious as possible in our vision of how to do what needs to be done. Now, part of my work is to try to help people shift the paradigm to think of these issues not as women's issues that some good men help out with, which is where still a lot of people are at in their thinking, but these are fundamentally men's issues. Now, they're also women's issues, and everybody in this room knows that, but We also have to understand them as men's issues and not just men helping out. And in addition to that, we have to understand these issues as leadership issues for men. And I just want to explain that for a moment because it does have some sort of framing aspect to it. What does it mean that these are leadership issues for men? Well, it means that if you're a man in a position of responsible leadership in this society, at whatever level you define that leadership, in your family, in your community, in your workplace, in politics, in business, in labor unions, in the sports culture, in education, in human services, however you define, in the military, however you define that platform that you have of leadership, by definition of that leadership platform, you need to be knowledgeable about domestic violence and sexual violence and the sexual harassment and the sexual abuse of children, and you need to figure out how you can use your platform of influence to address it and to use whatever means that you have at your disposal to expand the conversation, to hold other men accountable, not just younger men, but peer culture men as well. Not because you're a nice guy who's helping the women out, because so much of what we've done up till this point is really strong women in various institutional settings, in various communities, will go to men in power and ask for their help, right? They'll say, can you sign this check? Can you support this program? Can you attend this rally? Can you do this or that? And obviously, many of the men in this room are men who respond to that challenge, and there's other men who are not here who respond to that challenge. But that we need a paradigm shift from that thinking, that women are going to men and asking for their help. The men can either say yes or no. You understand? So they still have the power. We need to start saying, we expect you to write this check. We expect you to lead in this way. We expect you to use your platform of influence in whatever way makes sense. And if you don't, then we have to understand that you are failing in your leadership. This is a different way of thinking about the subject. I mean, I work on a lot of college and university campuses. And my program, the MVP program, we work with college and, you know, university athletic programs all over the country, and we have been doing this for almost 17 years. Now, I sometimes get emails, right, or on listservs that I'm on, where people will say things like, we have an hour with our athletic program, and, you know, they said that we can have an hour in our sexual assault prevention program. What can we do? What do you think is, what are some of the best methods that people have seen to effectively use 1 hour with the, you know, say with the football team? And by the way, a point of personal concern, we figured that out 20 years ago, okay? We shouldn't be asking those kind of questions. We should be sharing resources. We've been working with athletic programs for decades, okay? So we don't have to start asking, what do you do when you have an hour? We know, but the point that I want to make here is that we need to start thinking about our work beyond what you would do if you have 1 hour with the football team and say, why in 2009 isn't there a domestic and sexual violence prevention program in every college and university athletic program right now? Why is it not part of the expectation of the education of student athletes, both men and women, on every college campus? Are these not enormous problems? Yes, they are. Do student athletes and coaches and athletic administrators have an influential position on their campus? Yes, they do. Well, where's the disconnect? The point here is this all gets back to leadership and holding leadership accountable, right? So in other words, instead of putting it on the shoulders of a sexual assault coordinator, who's typically a young woman, sometimes a man, they're the responsible ones to make this happen. We need to start saying, okay, who's the athletic director on this campus? And who's the athletic director? And if the athletic director is not implementing a program for all the student athletes, for the coaches, why not? And if the athletic director is non-responsive to the idea that they should be doing it, then we need to find out who hires the athletic director. What is the chain of command, to use a military metaphor, in the university that who hires the athletic director, and then go to them and use whatever form of democratic accountability that we have at our disposal to say, this is a priority on our campus, and you're in a position, or these people are in a position to do something about this. There's all these programs around the country. There's all these methods that people have been employing successfully. Why aren't we doing it here? And if you're not the person that can make it happen here, we need to find somebody who will. And this is democracy 101, right? But if you take that example of the college athletic program and expand it to any number of different institutional settings, these are the kind of bigger questions that we need to be asking. system accountability, leadership accountability. The world changes much more quickly when people with power are either pressured to or enact a new policy, procedure, or way of thinking. Just a couple more points, and then I'll open it to my my fellow panelists. One of the things we need to do is figure out how to maximize the resources that we have currently, right? Because we don't have enough men doing this work, okay? We have a great gathering here. We have a lot of men. It's a growing number of men, both in the, you know, the United States and all over the world. You know, I was just part of, as some of us were, this big global symposium in Rio about a month ago, which was very exciting because there was 80 countries represented. Global symposium on engaging men in gender equality promotion and gender violence prevention. 80 countries. Great, okay? This is a great gathering, but we know that we don't have anywhere near enough men doing this work to change the world in the way the world needs to be changed, right? I mean, I travel, you travel, you look, go just walk down the street. New York is enormous, and you think about the numbers that we have here. Do you know what I'm saying? So we have to figure out how to maximize our resources better. And, it, you know, there's a famous quote from Bill Gates. He said, you don't have to work harder, you have to work smarter. And I think that's one thing we, you know, it's a piece of wisdom. We need to figure out how to work smarter and how to maximize our resources. And using the internet and using media technologies and leveraging leadership in different ways is one of the ways that we can maximize our influence. And, you know, we have decades of experience of working on the micro level or in the community settings. Okay, we have in this room, all these, I look around, some of my friends and colleagues and others who have decades of experience of working in this population and with that group of people. We have initiatives, we have programs, we have histories, and we know what works, and often we don't, you know, we know what works and doesn't work. We know what resources could enhance our work or what couldn't, but we don't have to start from scratch here. When we're talking about expanding stuff, we don't have to start from scratch. We have lots of knowledge. We just have to think bigger and think bigger systematic change. And if you create an initiative that's local, how do you replicate that program? How do you replicate that approach in another setting across the country, across the world? Right? I mean, this is the kind of vision we have to have. I mean, we're nowhere near enacting it right now, but we need to be talking about a bigger, expansive vision. Barack Obama is the president of the United States. Joseph Biden is the vice president of the United States. Those two men have the opportunity to be the most anti-sexist U.S. administration in history. Barack Obama has the opportunity to be the most effective anti-sexist male leader in human history if he rises to the occasion. But we need to push him. We need to push Joseph Biden. And I say that with all due respect. Barack Obama and Joseph Biden are important leaders. Joe Biden being one of the co-authors of the Violence Against Women Act and the Senate co-sponsors. Absolutely great. But there's so much more these guys can do. There's so much more that they have the platform, they have the influence, they have the power. And we need to be talking to them. We need to say that Barack Obama and Joseph Biden need to convene a meeting in the White House of all major leaders in all these different sectors of the economy, of politics. Imagine at the White House having a meeting with all the major mayors of major cities in the United States on what mayors can do to lead the fight against men's violence against women, which is a huge problem in every city in the United States. And when Barack Obama makes the call, guess who shows up at the White House? Right? Get all business leaders, big-time business leaders who have all kinds of financial resources. Get big-time labor leaders who have enormous influence in their labor unions. The president, the vice president, these kind of people can make that kind of thing happen. But we need to put it on their agenda. We need to push them. Right? We need to push them where we in a sense know they want to go there. Maybe they don't quite know where we want to push them, but we need to push them. And we need to say this as often and as loudly as we possibly can. And finally, one of the things that leadership has to do on these issues and has to incorporate into our work is a sophisticated understanding of the interconnections between domestic and sexual violence and a whole range of other social issues and social problems and social realities. Because, you know, domestic violence is not just some discrete issue somewhere, and sexual assault is some discrete issue, and sexual abuse of children, right? They're all interconnected, But they're also interconnected with issues of racism and the prison industrial complex and youth violence and gang violence. I mean, how do we talk about young men assaulting each other, and it, whether it's in gangs or not in gangs, assaulting each other and assaulting girls and women, and not talk about violence in their family of origin? You know how many boys commit antisocial acts as a response to the trauma that they've experienced in their childhoods and their families of origin and their community of origin? The prison system is absolutely filled with men who are violated as young men and boys and didn't figure out a way to deal with it other than the traditional way, which is to take it out on other people, right? How do we talk about the prison industrial complex in this country without, yeah, we got to talk about racism, of course. We got to talk about poverty, of course. But we also have to talk about violence and trauma and masculinity and masculinities. It's all interconnected. How do we talk about HIV, AIDS, and not talk about masculinity and male privilege? So much HIV transmission takes place by men who have unprotected sex with a prostitute, right? And they refuse to wear a condom, right? Which is an act of abuse against the prostitute. And then they have sex with their wife or their girlfriend and don't tell their wife or girlfriend that they had unprotected sex with a prostitute, and they transmit the virus, right? How do we talk about HIV AIDS prevention and not talk about masculinity? How do we talk about homelessness and not talk about gender violence and domestic violence? Over 50% of homeless women and children are fleeing abusive men, and they're more likely, when they're homeless, to be abused themselves, the women and children. How do we talk about homelessness and not talk about domestic violence? The point is, there's all these points of connection and other issues that lots of money and resources and activism is going towards, and yet the people doing that work and the policymakers making policy don't even understand the interconnection between those issues and the issues that we're all here to talk about. We need to start making those connections, and that's one of the responsibilities and burdens of leadership. And by the way, any man who claims that he's a social justice activist and doesn't include anti-sexism in his social justice consciousness has missed the boat. You can't be a man who's concerned with social justice and not be concerned with sexism. And so think about all the men in the various progressive social movements, both in this country and all over the world, who are good people, good men, but who not aware that sexism and all its manifestations is an essential piece of any social justice transformation that has to take place. So these are some of the kind of issues that I think hopefully will frame the discussion. I'm going to now turn it over to my colleagues. We don't have a formal sort of panel, you know, one to the other, but anything that these gentlemen want to say in response to anything I've said or anything that they want to say about their work that relates or whatever they'd like, the floor is yours.
Okay. Well, So the first thing that I had down in my notes was that we need to amplify the message and there's no need to be timid. So here's an example of someone who amplifies the message and there's no need to be timid. And I think that's really part of how I see things. I was, for a long time, working at one of the oldest pro-feminist men's centers in the country, the Men's Resource Center for Change in Amherst, Massachusetts, where I was editing Voicemail Magazine. And I decided about a year ago that I wanted to focus my energy, in terms of what we're talking about today, on amplifying this national conversation about men and masculinity. So the magazine is one way to do that. But there's a whole host of ways that I think that we all need to be ramping it up. Jackson referenced some of them. The media is really culpable. We really need to hold their feet to the fire a lot more than we do. I mean, I am sick and tired of hearing about the location of where girls and boys have been killed by men. I don't care that it happened at a school or a mall. Of course, that's important. But that's not, it's not a school shooting. It's a men and boys killing other men, boys, women, and girls. And so if we can't get the media to change the channel on that, then we're not doing our job. And that's what I mean when I say that we need to not be timid in our message. We need to go after them. We don't need to have Dr. Phil commenting on these kinds of issues. We need to be telling the media who to be calling. And our colleagues, our women in, like Rita Smith and people who are in national organizations, women's organizations that are getting calls from the media, we need to have our list of people like the panelists and the speakers who are here, available for all of us so that we can, everybody here, we need to have a mailing list of this conference, for one thing, so that we can all be in touch with each other. You know, it was occurring to me that an example of taking this to the next level is, I think it was one of the best things that happened when Ms. Foundation did the Take Our Daughters to Work and then later to Take Our Daughters and Sons to Work. So in keeping with this focus on the media, what about let's take our media to work, bring them to our organizations, show them firsthand what we're doing. And then I'm going to pass on the talking stick here to my brothers. There's lots of ways that we're plugged into male leadership in our community. Some of us have served on the boards of some of the do-good organizations like United Way. Those are men and women, but focusing on the men, who are in positions of leadership in communities, who can be the ones who can then go to the city councils and the mayors so that they're already on board when the call comes from Joe Biden's office, which, if we do our job, it will. And I guess the passion that Eve Ensler brought to this morning and the passion that I felt just now from listening to Ted, it's the fire in our bellies that we've got to just, we have to just feel viscerally and put into action, because there's not a lot of time. There's the greater global issues of the state of the planet, the health of the planet, and our work is part of what a great social theorist and thinker out in California, Joanna Macy, calls the great turning. And I agree with Eve completely that this shift is happening, but we have to speed it along.
I had a few thoughts about this, because my understanding is that we were trying to figure out how to take it to the next level, and this work to the next level, and to try to impact systems in different ways. And so what I wanted to do is talk a little bit about some of my musings around that issue. One of the things that I think we ought to do is break down silos. And what I mean by break down silos is the fact that we have to talk to people who believe what we believe, but we have to talk to people who don't. Because that's where the work is. Otherwise, we're preaching to the choir. And when we were doing some work with fatherhood groups, and I'm not going to be as kind as Ann was yesterday. I think that there are people who are heroes and sheroes who are doing some really interesting work, and I think they're knuckleheads. And so, but you had to figure out who's who. There's a organization in Madison, Wisconsin, now called the Center for Family Policy. They were formerly known as the Center for Fathers, Families, and Public Policy. One of the things that David Pate and Jackie Bojes did is they had a round table, and they called themselves a feminist fatherhood organization. What they did was they got people around the table, 40 feminists, not talking about from the battered women's movement necessarily or the sexual assault movement necessarily, but I'm talking about radical feminists, and put them around the table. And even though they did do that with battered women's and sexual assault, they ended up getting radical feminists to get around the table, and they said, I want you to tell me how our work will not hurt women. But they also live in an environment where there's fathers' rights groups, father involvement groups, and responsible fathers groups. And for them to, around funding and to have gravitas and some people who trust in what they do, they risk that in terms of trying to make sure that they provide a support in ways that's useful for women and children. That's something that I think is pretty impressive. There's another organization called the Center for Urban Families, and there's a guy named Joe Jones who runs that organization. And I knew Joe and knew David from a fatherhood conference that was in 93-94 that Vice President at the time, Al Gore, organized. And so I was on the panel with them representing domestic violence issues and sort of a lone voice. And what was interesting was the fact that Joe and David and I developed a relationship and started to sort of work some together. Joe, as a fatherhood organization, has a collaboration with the House of Ruth in Baltimore. They collaborate with one another. Fernando Medeiros and I wrote a curriculum for an Evolve curriculum in Connecticut that started to put in what is healthy fatherhood in a batterer's intervention program that's used at Yale and throughout Connecticut and other places. But one of the things that I thought was fascinating about that work and what Joe and what Lisa Nitch is doing with the House of Ruth is that they're trying to figure out how to reach people because they know that both of them have different issues that they need to work on. And it's another example of breaking down silos. We're trying to do work with the Institute on Domestic Violence in the African American Community to deal with the intersection of prisoner reentry and domestic violence. We're trying to do, but the other thing I think too is, what about boys' clubs and girls' clubs? What about Boy Scouts? What about, and I know Jackson has done things in the military and a number of other people have done things with military organizations in terms of being able to take the message. And I think one of the challenges around some of the groups is that when they're very rigid about not saying something, how do you get them to admit it, to acknowledge it? So in fatherhood literature, one of the things that they say is the best predictor of whether or not a father's going to have a good relationship with his children is dependent on the relationship that he has with the mother of the children. But nobody talks about how do you define that? How do you unpack that? If it's violence against women and intimidation, then that runs counter to the capacity to have a good relationship with the mother. So, and I think, again, having connections with churches and mosques and synagogues and getting ministers, because there are good examples of different ministers and imams and rabbis around the country who are doing really good work to be able to promote the notion. And I want to lead those breaking down the silos and talking about faith communities, too, to having an international movement that Ted and Tony are trying to do, that Jackson I know has been trying to do, to Rob and the rest of us, David and Etioni and Alianza, have been trying to be involved in. When I've gone to the UK, for example, and worked with them, they're dealing with challenges around men's movements that are trying to repress the good work around domestic violence, as we're dealing with those challenges. When I've gone to Canada, you know, they've had the same types of issues, and also in different African and Arab countries. But believe me, that there are men in those and women in those different countries who are also trying to be able to have a different statement and different stance around those issues. The other thing I want to say, too, is this. Sexism is not sexism is not sexism. And what I mean by that is that sexism, it gives men license to be violent towards women. But if we don't understand the different brands of sexism and the manifestations based on culture and country, we make a big mistake. Because those are things that I think we have to do to be able to help undo some things. And I also think, too, I think we study sometimes failure more than we study success. I wonder about men who do change. And what's their path to change? I think that what we have to do is figure out how people understand and explain and justify to be able to confront those issues. I remember in batterer's intervention programs when I used to do much more of that, that you'd have guys that would start to talk about faith issues. And so the conventional wisdom when I would go to different batterer's programs that people would say, we're not here to talk about that. But, you know, I think when you, or people who talk about how the Quran or how Islam might support violence, I think we got to talk about that. There are different people and there are different faith leaders in Islam that put fatwas out against domestic violence. But a lot of times we don't understand that. And the reason why it's important to deal with that is that when people keep pointing to Ephesians 5, I say read the whole chapter. So when people say things like, you know, the man is the head of the household, if you read the whole chapter, it also says that a man should treat his partner as though he should treat himself. And only a fool would hurt himself. And they talk about interdependence between the body of Christ and relationships and how there should be interdependence. Now, I'm an academic. I'm not a faith leader, but I go to church. So, and I believe in God. And I think that sometimes what we have to do is expand our message to be able to intersect with those systems. And I think that there's a national movement, a worldwide national movement. And I think some of the people here, particularly Tony and Ted and the work that I've seen Jackson do as well, could be an interesting thing to try to expand this and to get different people from different places to work together to give a different message and to challenge those things that have been put forward by people who are problematic. And I guess I want to say this lastly. Interacting with people who are part of fathers' rights organizations and men's rights organizations, they want to take things from women. And even though I've seen in England, they've done some interesting things in terms of trying, and in the United States, developing common ground with people. There are some people who you can't develop common ground with. But this is a muse that I have, particularly for people who believe in God. I wonder what it's like for people, what heaven is going to be like. I think we have to figure out ways, excuse me, to practice here on earth. I mean, particularly if we want to get to heaven, that we have to find ways to behave this way on earth before we get to heaven. And I think for those people who profess to have faith, need to engage in such concepts. So people who are connected with different faith organizations, men who are involved in thinking ways that they should engage with people. We have to find different ways to sort of behave. Thanks.
All right. We're trying to be circular here to avoid the line to go around. My name is Etione Alderondo, and let me try to put a context in some, for why I'm going to say the things that I'm going to be saying. First of all, you should all know you look beautiful from here. It's quite a beautiful place. I want to thank Call to Men folks for having me here and giving me the opportunity to kind of like come to the stage with so many of the people who have inspired me over the years, and some of who really got me involved in the movement pretty much 20 years ago. It was Oliver was the person who first came to me. He saw me as a young researcher and said, listen, there's a group forming, something called Alianza. My wife is involved. You should call them up. And that was just about 15, 17 years ago, and we're still there. Dick Bathrick, who was around here, was a good friend of my dissertation advisor. And also, after I described to him what I'd done for my dissertation, which was about understanding change in men who matter, he said to me, but why? Why are you really doing this work? Why? And that question kind of like continued to kind of like stay with me over the years. Why am I doing this? Let me tell you something to answer the question about, from my perspective, about the scaling up. And I think, to some extent, we have followed in the field of domestic violence and in the movement a very predictable path. We have done nothing different than every other area of the human services and mental health professions who initially were formed, came out of a commitment to social justice issues and aspirations. This was true in social work. This was true in psychiatry, in medicine, with the mental hygiene movement. It was true in family therapy with the work of Salvador Minucci and Family of the Slums. It was true with psychoanalysis, with the free clinics. It's true in every branch of what we now call the mental health professions. They all started with an understanding that whatever was happening, that the world was not fair, and that the odds were not right, and that people could not make it if we didn't really work to make significant changes in the way that our society was working. And like us, who also recognized that, we began to work and to promote particular visions on how that justice could take place. And like us, we began to kind of like become more silos-oriented. We began to be more preoccupied with our own, do we have the right certification? Do we have the right language? Do you pledge allegiance to the flag before we let you in? And so we are on a very predictable path. We're on a path of kind of like ameliorating and kind of like minimizing the social justice basis of our work, unless we take a different step, unless we intentionally decide not to become professionals, not to really, which by the way, if we let psychologists and others in our field, that's what's gonna happen if we don't watch it. That's what they wanna do in many respects. Now, I think one of the greatest success for me of the way in which the domestic violence movement has done its work for the last 20, 25 years, it has to do with the great job that we've done at creating structures and ways of thinking that had to do with protection. You know, the protection of women, the protection of children. And that we have done well. But we have come to believe that the job of protection is the job. And in my way of thinking about it, I think I like to invite people to think about the four P's, kind of like the four P's of domestic violence intervention and social change, which I call partnerships for protection, prevention, and promotion. Partnerships because we know from the health field, from public health, from research is clear in this, that everything that we do that has to do with social ailments and concerns, when it's done in partnerships, works a lot better. Because the solutions that we're seeking for are not individual achievements, are collective achievements, as Ted was reminding us. So to do anything else that is not working in partnership with others is, I think, is to do our work with our hands tied to our back. This speaks to this issue about whether or not we can collaborate with others that have different views from us. And in at the entrance of my research space, I direct a research center called the Don Spau Dalton Community and Educational Wellbeing Research Center. And in the entrance, we have in our student road a few months back a statement that says, be the movement. Be the movement. And that came out of a conversation that we were having about this whole issue of joining movements. Oh, as you can imagine, a lot of my students are doing all sorts of things through town. They're really involved in all sorts of things. And I had told them, you know, I don't want you really to join a movement. You know, there's a set of principles, there's a set of values and concerns that I think should permeate, at least in my experience, the way that I approach every issue. It's about strength-based, it's about prevention-oriented, it's about empowerment, it's about community change. So I really, when I'm working with on homelessness issues, when I'm working with a community partnership for the homeless, for example, and other organizations in Miami, I'm there thinking, I'm a partner, a value partner with them, and I'm also thinking about domestic violence. And I bring them in if I notice there's something we can do. And they might not even know they are a partner now working on domestic violence issues. They might not agree, and in fact, they may disagree in many ways with some of the orientations, some of the explanations that we give. But I figure we have to kind of like, it is that compatibility of values that I seek to partner, not so much a commitment to really end violence against women, to put it bluntly. I think I am looking for that for moving the needle. And I think that to move the needle, if we move it just a little bit every day, we end up in a very, 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 very different place. Now, the other piece that has to do is there's a protection, there's partnership, there's promotion. I think we don't pay enough attention to the idea of what are the conditions that we really need to promote so that we have healthy individual, healthy relationships, and healthy communities. And well-being happens at the synergy of all those three levels. And if we, as a movement, abandon that, if we don't think that healing our men is necessary, if we don't think that the current conceptions of masculinity are killing our men, that men in the United States have higher rates of, they die at a younger age than in other countries that have less, where the levels of inequality are kind of like, are not as sharp as they are in our country, then we fail to know that. We're really, this is killing our men, this is affecting not only women, and I think the battered women movement, domestic violence field needs to take that into account. They need to also openly and directly and intentionally take men's issues as part of their concern. And then, what was the other piece? I have a lot of different notes in here, so. The issue, Ted mentioned the notion about crossing the line and for men, and which resonates to me. We talked a lot about in the clinical work that we do about the importance of moving the line. Kind of like that. So I was very happy to hear him said talking about crossing the line. But the idea of we have to continue to move the line and to know, and to do so intentionally, in a sense, not accidentally. I think we're living in an interesting time. Let me just at least finish this part by saying that I'm very optimistic. I think we're living in a, this is a very difficult time. Obviously, we all know what is happening around the world and in the economy in the United States. But it's also an interesting time for human service professionals because there is a greater awareness about the need to transcend the existing paradigm. There is a greater awareness that we have been limited. We have self-imposed limitations there that we have existed in silos. And there is a greater commitment and understanding. There's a greater awareness, by the way, of the strength and limitations of research and research findings to guide our actions. So I think most responsible researchers know now that science can tell us a little bit, but not really, really guide the path, you know, tell us exactly where to go. And I think there's a lot of more humility among the folk, a lot of us who are working in the field. And I'm hopeful, because I think that in doing so, there's a lot of people who have a who are really finding ways of both promoting individual healing and social transformation in their work and making a life a commitment to do so all the time, not in an intentional manner. Thank you.
I want to start by thanking Ted and Tony and A Call to Men for also including me in today's events. This has been a powerful two-day conference, an amazing two-day conference. And we didn't plan out what we were going to do necessarily here, but I think it kind of works well to, as we're talking about next steps, to also talk about the past. So I want to harken back to some past issues. I also want to say there's an old saying that there isn't anybody who doesn't become more interesting when they stop talking and start listening, but I'm not sure if that's true today. I've appreciated what I've been hearing from this panel, from today's work, from yesterday's work. I work in a batter intervention program and have been working in one for the last 23 years. And about 5 years ago, we incorporated a custom into that program. It's a word that we took from one of our colleagues who was teaching us about African customs and traditions, and the word is Sankofa. And the Sankofa is a mythical bird from Africa that in order for it to fly forward, it has to be looking backwards. So that as it's moving into the future, it keeps an eye on the past. And how we use that in the program is for someone as they're moving out of the program after being there for a year, they talk about what they've done, what brought them there as they're moving into the future. So for me, one of the things that I heard strongly yesterday, heard strongly today, is that past. That when I first started in this work, I thought, well, okay, here I'm a social worker. I can bring some clinical understanding to this work because it seems like just a lot of activists are doing this. And I thought I had something to add. And I was quickly humbled by the understanding that there may be a place for that kind of clinical understanding. But really what you need to do is you need to listen to the leaders in this movement. And they were kind enough and patient enough with me to teach me about what I needed to be doing in this work, to teach me to listen to battered women's voices, to guide the work that I do. And one of the things that I'm fearful of as we're moving into the future is that some of that wisdom isn't necessarily transferred into our peers who are coming into this work today. And I think it's part of our responsibility, our Sankofa, if you will, is to remind them about that, to teach that to them, to let them know that you don't deserve to be at the table, like I hear so many times. You know, we deserve to be at the table. No, you don't. And I would take that one step further, that in terms of the phrase, a well-meaning man, I don't get to call myself a well-meaning man. The women in my community or communities get to decide that. So I do understand the concepts. And if I'm doing something that is an indication that I'm a well-meaning man, well, that's good. And that's what I want to be doing. Along the lines of what we heard yesterday, and I think it was Irene who brought it up, about the comment about the organizations, the women's organizations in the community being paranoid. There's a difference between being trusted and being trustworthy. And if I'm focused on what that organization's thinking about me, then I'm thinking about being trusted. But if I'm focusing on me and the part that I'm doing in this community, in this work, in this movement, then I'm focused on being trustworthy. And then the issue isn't about their being paranoid. Paranoid is something different than everyone who has come before you has burned me. I had an opportunity to do some mentoring work with a coworker's son who was a 22-year-old young man and is dealing with custody issues. And the more I talked with him, and I've known his family for probably 15 years, this is a young man who is an incredible father. And he was talking about his struggles with the family court system. And one of the things I said to him was, you know, the family court system does not know what to do with you. They know what to do with the other 999 men who've come before you. But in terms of somebody who's doing what you're supposed to be doing as a father, they don't really know what to do with you. But you have to bear the burden of those other 999 men who've come before you. And so we have, whatever programs we're doing, batter intervention programs, activism programs, men's organizations, we have to deal with what has been set by our predecessors. And it's not a matter of this organization is paranoid. It's a matter of, I've already said that. Two other things I want to draw attention to, just in terms of the future now. Much of the work in batter intervention relies on the criminal justice system, and that's fine and good. But that isn't where all the batterers are, as Ted pointed out earlier today. I believe, I was saying this to Jackson as we were walking over here this morning, there are more men that go to church than go to court. And if we want to reach out to where the men are, we need to reach out to the churches. And we need to look for the day when we can see more men in batter invention programs or consciousness raising programs or activism programs that are coming there from the churches or the faith community than are coming from the criminal justice system. Similarly, we also need to be working with the men who are in the prisons. I don't know if you've had a chance to be in prisons. I've had a lot of opportunity to be in prisons. I get to leave too, that's a nice part, but the despair that is going on in the men's lives in the prisons. And I've been in prisons in a couple of different states and all over my state of Michigan. There is a lot of work to be done in that arena as well.
Thank you very much. We have a few more minutes, so we're going to open the floor up for any questions or comments that anybody wants to make about any of these issues or whatever seems appropriate. So we'll have the mic for you in a moment.
As a form of violence against women at this conference has been violence against women in systems of sexual exploitation and the commercial sex trade. So I was wondering if you discuss issues of sexual exploitation in the work you do with men and what that looks like, and if not, why not, and how can we include that as a form of male violence against women?
That's a very good question. I think there's a woman named Denise. There's actually two people I recommend we include in this conversation. One is Denise Donnelly. She's a professor at Georgia State University. And another person is Carolyn West. She's a professor at University of Washington, Tacoma. And what we try to do is in one of our batterers intervention curriculum is to include conversations about that in the work that we do. But also the Violence Against Women's Office is really working on trying to do that. They're beginning having conversations. Catherine Pierce was involved with it, but Darlene, are you around? Darlene Johnson has been holding roundtables to have conversations about some of those issues. And there's a Polaroid project or Polaris project that's been trying to do some thinking around that and finding ways to include some of the conversations in that. And I think it is an interesting connection in terms of working with some men who've been working with us around dealing with prisoner reentry and domestic violence issues, because I keep lessons learned in terms of how they've transformed, but some of them were pimps. And some of them were people who sort of engage in conversations and issues, because what Ted and Tony talk about in terms of dealing with definitions of manhood and dealing outside, going outside the man box, I think those are things that we have to think about, have conversations with. And I think we have to do more conversations, because sometimes the way that we talk about it when we do batterers intervention is not the realities of the men who we're working with. So if you're dealing with a man, when we did part of one of the studies that we did, we found that women in prison usually don't get visitors. Men in prison usually have three: the woman that benefited from the crime, and two other women that they're selling dreams to. How do you talk to them about sexism? In the ways that we oftentimes have conversations with these guys, it doesn't consider the things that they think about and talk about. And we have to figure out ways to engage in conversations and change, in those ways. But so, yes, we're trying to think about that, and there are more people, I think, doing it. Including there's a project here in New York about, and there was a video on Showtime called Very Young Girls, who it moved me to such a great extent. So.
Can I just add to that, because I'm glad you raised that question. And yes, myself and a lot of us do include in our work the issues of sexual exploitation, but it should be on the record that sexual exploitation covers a wide range of behaviors. And again, in the spirit of this discussion about scaling up, we need to talk not just about what we say to individual boys and men, but how we hold systems accountable. I'll give you an example. I was just at a professional baseball game with my 7-year-old son, and there was a big Hooters ad in the stadium. I mean, huge. You can't miss it. Hooters is institutionalized sexism, and you could say sexual exploitation. The pornography industry is an enormous industry of commercial profitability of the sexual exploitation. So it's not just trafficking in women, obviously. It's a whole spectrum, and there's a whole bunch of institutional ways that we men support those industries or remain silent in the face of those industries' exploitative practices. And when we want to really be honest here, you know, it's not just a handful of traffickers who are doing the bad stuff to these girls and women, but rather a whole systemic support on many levels. Our consumer dollars, paying for, you know, movies that we go see, and frequenting strip clubs, and paying for pornography, and staying at hotels that have pornography, and child pornography almost on the internet systems. In the internal systems of those hotels. I go to hotels and I pay my money. I'm thinking I'm complicit here because I'm paying money to a hotel that's profiting off of sexual exploitation of children. So. Thank you for asking the question.
Jackson, I want to tell you, there's an organization of men in Minnesota that is having a conference, and I met the guy a couple weeks ago. But he said that he went to a resort community, and they said that they wanted to hold the conference there, but what they got them to do is to take anything that dealt with pornography off the channels because they said they wouldn't support the conference if they did it. And then they ended up going through the state to be able to make it a statewide effort to try to do something like that. So I thought it was interesting.
That's a really good idea. Imagine if state coalitions who are doing conferences, that's a really good idea. Imagine if coalitions who are doing conferences or men's conferences or anything related were to say to the hotels, do you have on the internal system here at the hotel this pornography available? And if they do, and you say, well, if you can't take it off, then we're not going to take our business elsewhere. That's exactly the kind of institutional response that we need to happen. Thank you. Couple more. We're running out of time, but a couple more people who have their hands up.
Sorry, I'll go quick. Jackson, my question is for you. Actually, I work at UPenn, so I am that young woman who calls the athletic department and gets told that you have an hour of time to talk about these issues. And I appreciate your kind of, you know, words of inspiration, but I think what's difficult for me is no matter what, I'm in a very vulnerable position because I want to take that hour that they give me and do what I can with it. But I also want to question that and want to go up the ladder. But I'm just one person, and I'm already so disposable to so many people on this campus, and there's so many people who think that I have no place there and there's no reason for me to even have this hour, that by going up that ladder and by asking these questions, I feel like I'm putting, not only could I be out of a job, which realistically I just need, but I'm losing that hour and I'm losing this little bit of space that I have been given. So I guess kind of as a younger generation of people trying to do this work, what I would ask from you and from a lot of the people that I've been doing it for a while is, what do I do? How do I get past that? You know, how do I compromise being given these kind of little pieces of space without, you know, at the same time kind of giving into this hierarchy of being just told what I can do and what I can't? Sorry, that's a loaded question.
Thank you. Really briefly, I appreciate the question, and it's a complicated. And I wouldn't tell you that you should or should not do anything. You do whatever you think you have to do, but the pressure should not be on you to make those calls and to feel like you can't, you know, keep your job if you say what you need to say. I think the pressure needs to be shifted off of women like yourself and onto higher levels of accountability. That's what I'm saying, and that's not easily done. But I appreciate the position you're in currently. But we need, for example, we need to expect that in the training of athletic administrators, domestic and sexual violence prevention is part of the training in college and graduate school. When you're going to be hired to be an athletic director at the University of Pennsylvania, you should have already been on your resume. It should show that you have had experience being trained in these issues. You understand that your role as an athletic administrator is beyond hiring coaches who are going to win games, but you have a much bigger responsibility than that. And therefore, those people who are wanting to become athletic directors will take the courses in college and graduate school. They'll get trained. They'll be part of these programming. And then when they become athletic directors, they'll have a different consciousness and they'll be able to do things differently. But this all has to happen systematically, or else individuals like you will be stuck with, I don't know what to say, I'm not sure what I should say, and my job might be at risk if I say what I really want to say. It's not fair to you, and it's not how we make systematic change.
Can I make a recommendation? I'm concerned because I don't want to talk a whole lot, but a thought. Go to the panel at a council. Get the sororities to stand with you around this issue. Talk to them about, and one of the things that I think about is there's got to be a structure, because students rotate. In terms of educating students, every year, because you turn over. Second thing, but it, with sororities hopefully standing with you, and also some fraternities, having conversations with the athletic director. I was a jock, believe it or not. I was a wrestler at a Big Ten university in my younger days. And I also did a thesis when I was doing my graduate degrees. And one of them was around athletes and the acceptance of violence between contact and non-contact sport athletes. What I noticed is that the coaches were trying to protect their players. So given people who have a greater voice, who are support, you don't have to be there by yourself. And I think I'd start with women, because it was the idea that Ted and Tony talked about in terms of finding ways to turn the conversation around. And then trying to have conversations with them about how that can be useful, but also expand it throughout all males across the campus, not only athletes.
We sadly have time for one last question. The big hook is about to be brought out. So one last question. Well, the microphone's in Russ's hand. So
I think for me, part of the conversation of scaling up is also scaling down. And I've been sitting here, and David, I appreciate your point around looking back and looking forward. And I was thinking about looking back, and 20 years ago, a handful of us organized an organization in D.C. called D.C. Men Against Rape, that at the time we had nationally the Men's Anti-Rape Resource Center to help provide resources and supports for local grassroots organizing around how do you get organized? How do you start a new organization in a town when you're starting from nothing, you don't know what you're doing? That organization grew. It is now Men Can Stop Rape, Inc. It's doing amazing things. Most of you know about it. I've now moved to Louisville. I'm starting a new organization there. We don't have anymore the Men's Anti-Rape Resource Center. And I know from conversations with men in Wyoming and men in Idaho and men in Mexico City and men in other organizations on the ground trying to figure out how do we start a new organization. And there isn't, in terms of scaling up, there isn't the same kind of institutional support of resources and sample bylaws and processes for how do you get your first board together and what are some grassroots fundraising strategies that seem to work before you're at a point where you can write those first grants, certainly before you can write the $10 million grants from the Department of Justice. And I think part of what we need to be thinking about is what, as we're scaling up, how do we scale up in a way that's scaling down and feeding the grassroots on an ongoing basis, because that's how the change happens. The change doesn't, we've said it before, the change doesn't happen from the top down, it happens from the bottom up. And as we keep scaling up, how do we scale down that's continuing to feed and fertilize the grassroots so that we can grow the kind of forest that we're trying to grow?
I know we're just getting ready to go. I just wanted to share that in the spirit of mentoring the next generation and bringing new leaders into this work, there is another conference that's happening, the National Conference for Campus-Based Men's Gender Equality and Anti-Violence Group. It's scheduled for the weekend of November 6 and 7 at St. John's University in Collegeville, Minnesota, bringing together college males who are working around in different campuses rejecting the old conventional ideas of manhood and who are looking to hook up and to understand what they're doing, not that hook up, looking to understand the work that's going on campuses so that we can strengthen this work together. And I won't say any more, but it's on page 6 of your voicemail magazine.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much for your participation. And we'll look forward to the next panel with a lot of the young men and Byron Hurt. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining Prevent Connect Audio. Prevent Connect Audio is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views presented on Prevent Connect Audio are not necessarily the views of the United States government, the CDC, or CalCASA. You can contact us at info@preventconnect.org, or you can learn much more on our website at www.preventconnect.org.